and China. The U.S. has vetoed three previous resolutions before the Security Council that called for a ceasefire without any conditions, such as the release of hostages. And in weather today, it is 48 degrees in Washington under cloudy skies. From WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Greetings. Y bienvenidos a todo mi gente escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, March 22nd, 2024. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on Honduras by examining some little-known events that took place in the 1980s and how they remain relevant to the country's political present. Civil war in El Salvador, civil war in Guatemala, the U.S.-supported Contra War against the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, the U.S. invasion of Panama in 1989. These are the stories that defined the history of Central America in the 1980s, a history of blood and U.S. intervention that still defines the region today. But as our guest today will tell us, while Honduras was not in the throes of war to the same degree like their neighbors during this period, it was still under a repressive government. As a result, the struggle for social justice in Honduras during this period has been grossly overlooked. So you'll be surprised to find out what our guest discovered and how it remains relevant in Honduran society today. So we have once again with us freelance writer, producer, and documentarian Michael Fox. He is the host of both the Brazil on Fire podcast and his most recent project, Under the Shadow, which is a co-production of both NACLA and the Real News Network. He joins us once again. You can hear the birds in the background. Welcome back to the show, Michael Fox.
Thank you so much. Such a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely, man. have to say, I consider myself a Latin American history nerd, but when it comes to finding out amazing and overlooked stories in Latin American history, you found a treasure trove of stories in Honduras never before heard about. So again, I would like to consider myself as a Latin American history nerd, but you unearthed some things that have been grossly overlooked during this time period. So as a matter of fact, here's one clip from your Honduras episode of Under the Shadow that I want to point out here. So let's take a listen.
The U.S. had a long history here, invading at least six times in the first decades of the 20th century. Honduras was a quintessential banana republic. United Fruit, the massive Boston-based banana corporation, reigned supreme. In fact, the 1954 CIA coup in Guatemala that we talked about in episode two, well, that was staged from Honduras. By the 1980s, this was the place the United States would use to wage its proxy wars abroad, to train its paramilitaries and military officers, to launch its operations, and to roll out its strategy across the region. And within Honduras, that meant squashing any revolutionary activity that could destabilize this important ally. The impact on the country was tremendous.
So that's a snapshot of Under the Shadow, which you produce, again, with both NACLA and the Real News Network. And that's just a small sample of some of the things that we'll be discussing here. So before going through specific examples of Honduras' overlooked struggle for social justice in the 80s, can you explain sort of your approach to this particular episode of Under the Shadow? Because right off the bat, you mentioned that Hondurans themselves, at least the ones that you interviewed for this particular episode, had a hard time explaining what was going on in the country during this period, because it's one of those gray areas where it was a peace that was not a peace, and it was a war that was not a war. And this is precisely the type of gray areas that U.S. military and special forces tend to be opportunistic around, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because this is something that a lot of people I spoke with mentioned about the 1980s, was that they had a hard time explaining what was going on in their country because they'd have to give the whole backstory. Because it seemed like Honduras at the time was one of the positive examples in the region. I mean, you had wars in El Salvador, Guatemala, like you mentioned, you had the Nicaragua Sandinista that had just taken hold, but then you had the whole Contra War, which is being staged from Honduras. But the country was transitioning from dictatorship to democracy, supposedly. It was still authoritarian, but that was the idea, that there were elections that were held in 1982 or the end of 1981. They had redone a new constitution, which was passed in 1982. Of course, that was written, many people say, in like, or at least drafted at the U.S. embassy or in like in the U.S. military bases and things like that. But the idea was that Honduras was supposed to be the positive example for the region. And so people had a hard time when they try and get international support for what was happening there or support against the human rights violations, the disappearances, the killings. And it was really, really complicated because they had to explain the whole backstory first. So that, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things I talk about in the podcast a lot, which is kind of this central theme, which I think we should talk about a bunch today, is this question of silence. So much repression. The idea was to use the state apparatus, death squads, to use force and disappearances as a form of psychological torture in order to force the Honduran population into silence, to stop the people from organizing, to stop the people from getting out of the streets or to holding their own revolution like was happening in the neighboring countries. And so this silence really, it was, I mean, think of it as a cloud that kind of hung over the country for most of the 1980s and was really, really intense. And this is an interesting juxtaposition to that Honduras post-coup, which I talk about in the episodes that come later on, 2009, obviously, then you have just people pouring into the streets, in part in response to understanding what the silence did in the 1980s, saying, no, we cannot be silent. We actually have to organize. We have to be in the streets active post-2009. This episode is really interesting because at first I wasn't sure whether I wanted to focus on like Iran-Contra style stuff, because obviously it was so huge. And in fact, at first I started talking with people about Iran-Contra, and I said, you know, I want to dig into the Contra War and to what that meant and the training that was happening. And of course, that comes out in this episode. But most people said, look, yeah, that's important, but that's really happening. I mean, that's very important in Nicaragua, But here in Honduras, the repression, the state apparatus, Battalion 316, which I'm sure we'll talk to in a second, and the role of the U.S. government, the idea, which I get into the very beginning, this was like the USS Honduras. This was like a massive U.S. military base in which the U.S. had carte blanche to do with whatever it wanted throughout the 1980s. That was really, really, really key and really important, and then sets the scene for what happens, you know, later on, you know, within the 1990s and the 2000s and, you know, and on.
Yeah, it's almost as if silence, as you mentioned, was probably the biggest weapon that the authoritarian government in Honduras during that time period had over the Honduran public. It may not be that way in recent times because of other organizations that have come after the 80s. And so it's sort of like the analogy that I've always made about Uruguay, for example, during their dictatorship in the late 60s and early 80s, in that while human rights abuses in Uruguay wasn't to the same degree as more documented cases like Videla in Argentina and Pinochet in Chile, human rights abuses by any measure are still human rights abuses nonetheless. And it's always left me scratching my head why those social movements, those social struggle movements, have been either overlooked or not as well documented as their other counterparts in other parts of Central America as well. So because of that, while the stories of organizations like the FMLN of El Salvador and the Sandinistas of Nicaragua have been well documented, especially during this time period of the 80s, one organization that you highlighted in this particular episode of Under the Shadow that has been, in my opinion, overlooked around that time is COFADE, which is the Committee of Families of the Detained and Disappeared in Honduras. Can you tell us more about them and perhaps why they might be relevant even today in recent times?
Yeah, absolutely. So they were founded by family members of the detained and disappeared in 1982, and they began marching the first Friday of each month right next to Congress in Tegucigalpa. There's a plaza called the Plaza Merced. They call it the Plaza of the Disappeared, and they've been lobbying to get the name changed to the Plaza of the Disappeared. And this is where I start this episode at. And they've just been organizing ever since. They are still marching every Friday of the month. In the first years, the chant was, but it continues to be, that you took them alive, we want them back alive. So we're demanding our family members be returned. And of course, there were officially, according to the official numbers, there were 184 people disappeared throughout the 1980s in Honduras. And like I mentioned, that pales in comparison with what we saw in Guatemala, what we saw in El Salvador, and so many other countries during that time period. But it was an extreme form of psychological torture, and the idea was to silence people. It wasn't necessarily to disappear, but it was to stop the potential organizing. And I'm so glad you brought up Uruguay, because at the time, you know, in the 1970s, the government of Uruguay said, we're not going to disappear, we're not going to kill people, but we are going to torture so many people that we're going to make people crazy and we're going to scare people into silence. That was the state policy, and that's exactly what happened in Honduras. And so COFADE is really, really important because they are the most vocal people throughout this time period, and they continue to be vocal. And they're not just anybody, but they're mothers, they're sisters, they're family members who are saying, we want our family members back. And they remained important throughout the 1980s. In the 1990s, once things start to improve, then they started to try and locate some of the family members of the disappeared that had been taken from them. And so they started to do kind of unearthing processes, trying to find graves and mass graves, similar to what we saw in Guatemala and El Salvador kind of at the same period. And they found some people through this process, and they continue to be important today. They've continued to declare against the human rights violations. And in the days and the weeks and the months and the years following the 2009 coup in Honduras, then they were coming out with reports talking about the numbers of human rights violations and killed and disappeared. Berta Oliva, she's the leader of COFADE, the longtime leader of COFADE. She's been extremely important. I interviewed her for a long time, one afternoon in Tegucigalpa, and she walked me through kind of their shrine that they have in their office in downtown Tegucigalpa with all the pictures, black and white pictures of people that were disappeared in the 1980s, including her husband. And they're just extremely profound. The best connection that one can make to understand COFADE is, of course, the Mothers of the Disappeared. That's who they were inspired by, the Mothers of the Disappeared in Argentina, who had organized a few years beforehand, obviously, to demand their family members be returned in Argentina. And there's this strange Argentina connection that happens throughout obviously my episode, but throughout the 1980s, which I know that we'll get into later, that I wasn't aware of. But it also underscores how the dictatorships of South America, of the Plan Condor years of the 1970s and early 80s, were not just focused on South America, but that they were pushing their kind of power and training people abroad into the 1980s, even into Central America. So there's all these layers, but COFADE remains extremely important today.
Yeah, and as you just mentioned, they were at the forefront in documenting human rights abuses during the coup government years in recent times. And they've been hand in hand at the forefront of documenting these human rights abuses, along with more perhaps famous organizations like COPIN, which was the organization by the late environmental activist Berta Cáceres.
Yes.
And also OFRANE, which is the Afro-Honduran organization that I think started around the late 70s as well, which is another component sort of to give people an idea of the type of repression Honduras had in the 80s that was grossly overlooked. Now I want to indulge a little bit here to talk about some of the oddities that you unearthed during the course of this particular episode of Under the Shadow. So generally speaking, any references to Honduras during this time period in either books or documentaries typically cites the country as a staging ground for the country war, as you mentioned, against the Sandinistas, among other things. But as a perfect example of finding something under the shadow, get it? Can you tell us about what locals refer to as the flower of Vietnam? Before we had this conversation here, I had a hard time trying to figure this out because I could not find anything about this. And I had never heard of this story before. What is the flower of Vietnam here?
Yeah, so the flower of Vietnam, it's a venereal disease that essentially comes from Vietnam at the time. Vietnam vets, Vietnam soldiers who were in Vietnam, and of course in brothels, you know, in prostitutes. And it's this disease that spreads, and it happens, and it spreads in Honduras as well. So when the United States really kicks off its military base in Comayagua. Comayagua was the former capital of Honduras. It's now Tegucigalpa, just south of there, but about an hour north is Comayagua. And it's kind of nice colonial streets, and it has kind of this feeling of history that you would imagine seeing in that you've seen across Central America and whatnot. But the U.S. sets up its military base, Palmarola or Sotocano, which is just south of Comayagua. And what this one journalist told me, her name is Carla Lara, and she was an activist, a singer, very well known in Honduras. And she talked about this history of the flower of Vietnam and essentially just said that the use of prostitutes by U.S. soldiers at this base and prostitutes and brothels in this region of Comayagua just devastated this region with this venereal disease, the flower of Vietnam. And it's a terrifying story that many people that I had looked around, it's hard to find this online. You can see references to flower of Vietnam in other places, but not in Honduras. And so this was a really important find that she was bringing up and just said that it's kind of this under the shadow, it's just beneath the surface. It's this story of something that really ravaged this entire community, this entire town, that people don't talk about because it's covered up by whatever, everything else. And of course, this is happening at the same time that, you know, the wars are happening in the neighboring countries and things like that. But this was an important and really terrifying moment for that region and for what it did on particularly the female community in that region of Comayagua. So yeah, it's kind of a disturbing history of the U.S. past and the role that the United States and U.S. soldiers have when they move into a region like this.
Yeah, there's almost no reference to it. The only thing that came to my mind when I heard this part of the podcast was sort of a passing reference to the Stanley Kubrick film Full Metal Jacket, because they sort of like made a reference to something similar to the effect of that, but in Vietnam, not necessarily in Honduras.
Yeah.
And one more thing about Sotocano that I could find with regards to this particular portion of Under the Shadow was that this was also the same air base where Manuel Zelaya was taken, you know, when the coup d'etat in 2009 actually took place. So like I said before at the beginning, some of these things that took place in the 80s don't just happen in a vacuum.
Yeah.
They still remain relevant even today in recent times. So man, that is an amazing story, and it would be amazing even more to find, if it's at all possible, to find even more about this. So let's talk about the Hotel Honduras Maya, because this is something that also caught my attention. And to do so, I have another clip here from Under the Shadow that I want to play for you. Here we go.
Great.
On a hill overlooking downtown Tegucigalpa is a tall beige 12-story building known as the Hotel Honduras Maya. Today, it's still one of the nicest four-star hotels in central Tegucigalpa. But back in the 1980s, it was the spot. Arthur Stephen Kinzer wrote about it in an excellent 2001 piece for the New York Review. You'll remember I spoke with Kinzer in episode 2 about the 1954 CIA United Fruit coup in Guatemala. In the 1980s, he was a correspondent for the New York Times in Central America. About the Hotel Maya, he writes, "When a country finds itself at the center of world history, it begins attracting spies, mercenaries, war profiteers, journalists, prostitutes, and fortune seekers. Often they gravitate to a particular hotel. In Honduras, which was shaken from its long slumber in the 1980s and turned into a violent staging ground for cross-border war, the Maya was that hotel. Counter-revolutionaries hatched bloody plots over breakfast beside the pool. You could buy a machine gun at the bar. Busloads of crew-cut Americans would arrive from the airport at times when I knew there were no commercial flights landing, spend the night, and then ship out before dawn. They said they didn't know where they were going, and I believed them. Friends told me that death squad torturers stopped in for steak before setting off on their night's work. But in those days, much of what anyone said in Honduras was a lie. That was certainly true at the Maya, and equally so at the American Embassy a couple of miles away."
So that's another clip from the Honduras episode of Under the Shadow that I wanted to share with you. And I want to see if you could tell us not only about the Hotel Honduras Maya and how it serves as sort of a microcosm to the brazen presence of the U.S. military at the time. Obviously, this is not a film review, but another film that came up to my mind when I heard this portion of the podcast was Oliver Stone's Salvador, which is around 1985, 1986. And I bring that up because there are like scenes in that film of reporters and Salvadoran military people at that time all congregating in this same hotel. And so it sounds kind of perverse right now to think about it, that something like that would happen in recent times, but it was kind of okay and accepted for military people and journalists, you know, American journalists, to congregate in the same place, considering what was going on around them during that time. And it just shows the sort of brazen normalization of war crimes that were being committed during that time period.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me just step back for a second. One of the interesting things about this episode, this entire series I worked on while traveling through Central America. And so I would be in certain countries for, you know, several weeks. In the case of Honduras, I was there for, you know, several weeks, and then I'd move on to the next spot and I'd be there for a month or two. But then I was developing and actually writing the script for these episodes later on, right? And so the story of Hotel Maya, the story of El Aguacate, which comes in later on, which was a kind of a clandestine military base. These were places that only later on did I realize, oh man, I needed to go to those spots. Oh, I need, like, because that's the whole idea, is I'm going to different places. And so this was an interesting episode because obviously I went to several spots, as you hear throughout, Sotocano, the front gates of Sotocano, and of course the Plaza Merced and Cofade. But I also had to be kind of creative in how I was going to bring people to those locations and then look back in the history without actually being there to describe it myself, right? And so this is obviously one of those places, and using this clip from Stephen Kinzer, which is just such a great clip. And in fact, Greg Grandin refers back to this in Empire's Workshop. Yeah. And it's so descriptive and so powerful because it is such a spotlight on that moment of this confluence of so many layers of things that were happening at the same time in this one location. And it is interesting that he mentions this, kind of, when a country finds itself in the center of world history, it begins attracting spies, mercenaries, war profiteers, journalists, prostitutes, and fortune singers, and they all oftentimes come together, you know, gravitate to a particular hotel. And it's not just here, it's not just El Salvador, but for instance, during the Spanish Civil War, you saw this as well at this hotel that, you know, I remember Ernest Hemingway and Martha Gellhorn and all these other layers of journalists and all sorts of different people in Madrid, they would all go to the same similar hotel. So it's a thing that's, you know, if we look back at history, that's happened. And this was one of those spots. You know, later on, then, of course, like finding Hotel Maya online and looking like what it means today, it's just fascinating. This idea of what I want to do with Under the Shadow and what I've tried to do of walking to places in the present and then walking back in history to understand the past. It's crazy when you think of just what's under the surface. And in Honduras, all of these things are just under the surface. I'm sure we'll get into kind of the clandestine torture areas and detention zones, kind of that are pockmarked all across the countryside in old homes and buildings and things like that. But everything is so hidden in plain sight. It's so hidden in plain sight in Honduras, almost more than anywhere else. It's really fascinating.
I'm kind of laughing right now because it just occurred to me that some bits of your description of the Hotel Honduras Maya kind of sounds like the Continental from the John Wick films. You know what I'm saying? That this weird confluence of criminals and other people of that ilk are all congregating in this place, sort of being polite amongst one another. And it's not just a description on a podcast. You can see it visually, like I said, in the Oliver Stone film, yeah. Salvador. And I applaud you for really going back and finding some archival information about this particular hotel because it inspired me to go way back. I actually found a New York Times article from 1984 about a description of this very same hotel. Wow. And I can read you the quote here. It says that at the Hotel Honduras Maya, in the center of Tegucigalpa, the elevator lets out a stream of off-duty American soldiers in jeans, knit shirts, and jogging shoes. A U.S. Army colonel says the place reminds him of the Hotel Majestic in Saigon at the height of the Vietnam War. So there's another reference there to sort of the whole Full Metal Jacket analogy that I mentioned earlier. I want to bring our attention to something you mentioned earlier that I think needs a little bit more details, and that's Battalion 316. I'm a Salvadoran. I'm familiar with the death squads in El Salvador. We've documented that on this show several times. One of the most infamous, I would say, is the Adlacato Battalion, which is just a horrendous, you know, co-opting of a Salvadoran folk hero's name and using it to name a death squad. But tell us more about this. I know we're going to talk about Argentinians being involved here, but I want to put that aside if possible at the moment and just focus on Battalion 316 because the whole Argentina thing is a mess in and of itself.
That's right. Exactly. Well, so according to what we know and understand, Battalion 316 began, trained, formed by General Gustavo Alvarez Martinez. He was a close ally of John Negroponte, who was the ambassador from 1981 to 1985. He himself was trained at the Argentine Military College and then at the School of the Americas. And 19 members of Battalion 316 were trained at the School of the Americas. I mean, obviously, this was just a horrific death squad, similar to what we've seen in other places, disappearing people, picking them up in broad daylight, removing them, clandestine torture centers and everything. What is fascinating in particular is what we know about the U.S. involvement and the U.S. role in training them, not just from the School of the Americas. The Baltimore Sun did, and this is one of those other things that, like, so much of my reporting for this episode are things that were reported on before, but they're just lost in history, right? Like, just buried under so many layers of everything else. But the Baltimore Sun did a lot of reporting back in the 1990s, specifically focused about the U.S. role in the region, the U.S. role of training the Contras, the U.S. role of training Battalion 316. What they said was that the CIA, this is what the Baltimore Sun, in one of their reports from that time, the CIA was, quote, instrumental in training and equipping Battalion 316. Members were flown to the United States, given training there, and then given training in clandestine bases in Honduras. Declassified documents from the CIA that was actually forced after the Baltimore Sun articles came out in the mid-1990s prove that the CIA knew about hundreds of human rights abuses that were happening, killings by the Honduran military and Battalion 316, but did nothing and didn't report on them. And there's actually a CIA training manual that is still available at the National Security Archives. in which it walks through the different forms of training in Honduras. And it's interesting that you could tell, like, there was the original drafting of this training manual, and then someone wrote in, crossed some things out, and then wrote in like, oh, we don't do that anymore. Oh, you should not try and use coercive measures. Oh, like as if they're trying to make it seem as though it's not, like they want to downplay the amount that coercive torture is used and whatnot. But all of this is profound. Obviously, Battalion 316 is a terrifying moment and still remains. That legacy still is today, like that legacy of fear and psychological torture like we've talked about. Berto Oliva, you know, the founder of COFADE, her partner, when he was captured in June of 1981, I think they had been married for 3 months and she was a few months pregnant and he was 33 years old at the time and he was taken in broad daylight. She was there. And so Battalion 316 was a terrifying death squad at the time, trained, supported by the United States, and continues to have this terrifying, devastating legacy today.
And much like everything else that we've discussed during the course of this conversation, these are things that are hidden in plain sight. And the thing about the torture documents that you mentioned, it's not like documents disappear and then they're automatically unlearned. It's something that becomes generational, especially for those in power with regards to keeping people marginalized. And again, I want to stress this again, these are the sort of things that, you know, explain a lot with regards to what's happened with the coup years in Honduras in recent times, and how these things don't happen in a vacuum as well. We're speaking with Michael Fox. He's a freelance writer, producer, and documentarian. His recent project is Under the Shadow, which is a co-production of both NACLA and the Real News Network. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned. That was 80s by Killing Joke, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can follow us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about Honduras in the 80s with Michael Fox, who's a freelance writer, producer, and documentarian, and the host of Under the Shadow, which is a co-production of both NACLA and the Real News Network. So of all the things, Michael, that stopped me in my tracks in this episode of Under the Shadow, it was the involvement of both Argentinians and Cuban Americans in military training in Honduras. And as a matter of fact, I have another clip here from Under the Shadow that I'd like to share. So let's take a listen.
The training and advisory support for military actors, and particularly the Contras in Honduras, was not just happening through Washington, but through military officials from Buenos Aires. Remember, in the late 70s into the early 80s, Argentina was in the middle of its own devastating dictatorship. 30,000 people were killed or disappeared in the country's reign of terror. According to a 1993 landmark human rights report by Leo Valladares, a member of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, Argentine officials were active in Honduras from 1980 on. He writes that the courses were, quote, taught by teams of up to 10 Argentine officers and lasted from 3 to 6 months. According to the Baltimore Sun, it was paid for with secret funds from the United States. Valladares writes, "The Argentine experience in the Dirty War had a decisive role in the training of the Contras. They were carried out in training camps across Honduras until early 1984, when the Argentines were replaced by instructors from the United States, most of them Vietnam veterans and Latin advisors, mainly Cuban Americans." Researchers believe that Argentina's interest in training the Contras and Central America's militaries was to support the fight against the spread of communism and also to locate leftist Argentines who had fled the country's repressive regime.
So there's another clip of the Honduras episode of Under the Shadow. And we have to address two things in two separate questions here. One, Argentinian involvement, and two, Cuban-American involvement. So let's start with the Argentinians first, because I think one thing that we should probably try to clear up as best as we can is the timeline of Argentinian involvement with regards to the training of Honduran soldiers during this time, because Argentina became a democracy again in 1983. But that doesn't mean that the Argentinian generals who ruled during the Dirty War periods of 76 to 83 still didn't have interest in ruling the country again. As a matter of fact, you know, there was a film last year, Argentina 1985, that talks about how Argentinian generals still threatened the fragile democracy during that time period. There's a fantastic book by the late Clara Nieto called Masters of War. And she described the Argentinian military during this time period as an aristocracy by social origin, meaning that they were not just at the service of the aristocracy or creation of the aristocracy, but they had become an aristocracy unto themselves. So what were they doing in Honduras during this time?
This is a great question. I have the same one. I was shocked when I read this, but it's there. And they were there, you know, training the Contras. They were there spreading what they knew and what they had learned. And it's extremely concerning. If you look at what Argentina represented during its 1976 to 1983, I mean, tens of thousands of people disappeared. It is terrifying when you consider that these are the people that were there together with the U.S. government and U.S. military training the Contras who were attacking Nicaragua to try and overthrow the Sandinista government. And the Contras, of course, were then picked up as the freedom fighters. That's what Reagan called them, the freedom fighters.
Yeah.
So they're learning like disappearances, torture techniques, you know, violence from Argentine generals, like who are just destroying the country. And I think there's several layers of things here. There's the first layer that like, wow, how did they end up in Honduras, right? Like, all places. And of course, there's the U.S. connection. Of course, that's like, that's involved because, and I mentioned this briefly, is of course, they want to stop the fight of communism or the spread of communism, so-called communism. And at this same time, you have El Salvador's fighting, you know, the FMLN have, you know, are pushing back really strong on the bloodthirsty Salvadoran government since 1980. You have a Nicaragua, of course, the Sandinistas come to power in 79. And of course, Argentina sees that as concerning. And then you also have Guatemala. And so it's clear that they're like, well, let's see if we can go help out in, you know, neighboring Honduras and support the U.S., you know, role. But then you have this other question which lingers in my head. And that has to do with kind of the role of justice later on and responsibility. One of the things that people in Argentina have been able to do and victims of that time is to bring their tortures to trial, right? In a way that we haven't seen in many other countries. We haven't seen that in Brazil. Of course, Chile, that's happened to an extent, but in many other countries, they haven't been able to receive that level of justice. And of course, Honduras hasn't seen any of this. It's just pure impunity until today. And so it is interesting to look back at those years, to look back at the role of Argentina together with the United States, but also to jump forward to look at kind of the legacy still and the lack of accountability for the United States in Honduras, but also for Argentinians in Honduras, and also like the Argentine human rights abuses and disappearances and violence that took place in the 1980s.
And we don't really even know how many Argentinians actually were in Honduras during that time that were there for political reasons.
Right.
What's also confusing to me about Argentinians training military personnel down there, especially the Contras, is that the Contras were essentially the private security forces of Somoza before he was overthrown. So they already had some degree of training. You know, we could tie in the School of the Americas there once again, but to get even more training from particularly the fascist Argentinians during that time, just kind of at the very least is an example of how Reagan was a real fan of the fascists in Argentina to have them involved there.
That's right.
Now there, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of ambiguity there. When it comes to Cuban Americans, though, it's not that much ambiguity there because Latin American history has shown that they've been useful at the service of U.S. intervention in other places, not just Honduras as well.
That's right. No, absolutely. And, you know, one thing I do want to mention still is that, remember, and I mentioned this before, General Gustavo Alvarez Martinez, who was the general in the Honduran military at the time, he basically kicked off Battalion 316, led Battalion 316, and he was trained at the Argentine Military College as well. I feel like, Oscar, with this, there's so many things that I'm just scratching the surface on. You know what I mean? Like, even though it's an hour-long episode, it's still like, you know, you could do a whole Under the Shadow just on Honduras and then following all the wormholes to everything else that's happened. Like, you know, trying to dig in to understand how did Alvarez Martinez, how did he get to Argentina, right? Like, and were his connections important in terms of then bringing Argentine advisors, trainers to Honduras, or was it more of a U.S. connection? I do know that for a period, there was this moment where, from speaking with other people and from also listening to other documentaries and reading some research, there was a period where the Argentine military, and I'll get to Cuban Americans just a second, but there was a period where the Argentine military, as far as I understand, really wanted to take over that role of training and take over that role of fighting communism in Central America, almost like pushing the United States out of the way. And I think that there was almost like tension between the two countries about who would kind of expand and who would be able to do the better role of fighting communism in the region. As far as I understand, there's a bit of a tension on that floor as well. But then in terms of Cuban Americans, I go back to the same question. I feel like I've just scratched the surface. Some of these things I found kind of in reference and didn't have time or the space to really dig into deeply. We do know, for instance, like you said, that the United States was using Cuban Americans in its fight against Cuba going back a long time. We know that the Bay of Pigs invasion was launched from the coast of Guatemala, actually. After the 1954 coup against Arbenz. And so, you know, one of the things I really get into in this podcast that I think is really important and what I wanted to do in with this one in particular was to show how Honduras was the linchpin for U.S. policy in the region. And you have to see U.S. policy in the region as a regional policy. It wasn't just, oh, the U.S. is working in El Salvador over here. The U.S. is working on Nicaragua over here. It's Guatemala. The U.S. saw Central America as a larger region in and among itself, and Honduras was the staging ground for all of that throughout the 1980s. And so it wasn't kind of country by country. Of course, it did that and had people on the ground and whatnot, but really it was a much larger vision of how it was going to contain and push back on the so-called communist threat in the region. And Honduras was key. It was the most key country for the U.S. because it could do whatever it wanted there. And in fact, in my research, and I didn't get into it very much, but one of the massacres that happened in El Salvador during the war of communities took place on the border between El Salvador and Honduras. And at the time, you had the Salvadoran military that pushed people down toward a river, and I don't remember the name of it.
El Mozote?
It wasn't El Mozote. It was another one. Roberto Lovato speaks to it as well in his amazing book, Unforgetting. But basically, you had the Salvadoran military that pushed this community down towards this river. And at the same time, you had the Honduran military on the other side that were firing on people from both sides. And it's the way that Honduras was used. It was also used for training for people like soldiers from El Salvador and Guatemala. Like, they would move people around in the region and do trainings in Honduras at the same time for different soldiers in the region. And of course, the military, and then the Contras training, you know, they were fighting on so many different fronts. So like the Honduran military is actually fighting along that Western front against the FMLN and against guerrillas that were coming in from El Salvador and supporting the Atlacat battalion and the work of soldiers in El Salvador at that same time, right along the border, at the same time as it's supporting the Contras along the border with Nicaragua and then training anybody can possibly train throughout the entire region. It's a terrifying moment, but it was seen as the United States as kind of the linchpin within a larger regional strategy. And I think that's where the Cuban Americans come in. We know that, for instance, there's this one amazing interview in When the Mountains Tremble that was a documentary film, award-winning film, made about Guatemala and the U.S. role in Guatemala in the early 1980s, particularly under Rios Montt. And in that documentary, they interview a U.S. Green Beret who had served in Vietnam and speaks Spanish. And I think the U.S. really kind of appreciated the support of people who could speak Spanish at the time and who had served in Vietnam and were like from the United States, but of Latino origin. And so they could cross these borders and being able to do its training as best as possible. So I think that's where like the Cuban American angle comes in.
I believe it was the Rio Lempa River where this massacre took place. I think that's the one that you're referring to. I had to like really dig through my brain to like try to remember that one. So, oh man, you know what? This is the ultimate wormhole. This episode alone and right. Under the Shadow in general has been a fantastic wormhole of a project. And the term wormhole can sometimes be derogatory. This has been educational because you really dug deep into finding a lot of these stories that, as you said before, have been hidden in plain sight. So we have about a few minutes left. First and foremost, we are going to create a link to this episode and several other episodes of Under the Shadow so people can learn more about what we've been discussing here. And like I said before, these things are still relevant to Honduran society today, particularly Honduran politics. And in the coming weeks ahead, we plan to have a show dedicated to the recent case of former coup president Juan Orlando Hernandez in Honduras as well. And so we hope to have that done either by the end of this month or early April. But in the meantime, let's close out by going backwards again and putting the spotlight on COFADE. And I want to see if we could just give them a little bit more spotlight because, as we said before, their work is still relevant today. And also, if there are any other issues from this particular episode of Under the Shadow that deserves our attention, because again, a lot of this has been overlooked. Let's take the opportunity to give it a spotlight.
That's right. So before we get into COFADE, I just wanted to mention one thing that I think is really important. Obviously, with this podcast, a lot of what I try and do is walk back in time, look at the history, and then look at the legacy today. Like what happened back then to bring us to where we are now. And also, you know, we're walking in the present, but we're walking in the footsteps of the past. Those same ghosts, those spirits exist, right? And so one of the things that we haven't mentioned yet, which I think is really important, which I try and get into in the podcast, is how much this was kind of a staging ground for the United States, but also a staging ground for U.S. officials who would then become important in the 1990s, particularly in the 2000s with Bush in the so-called War on Terror, right? And you have names like John Negroponte, Roger Noriega, Elliot Abrams, Otto Reich. These people, like, they're through lines that would kind of get their start in the 1980s in Honduras, either involved in the Contra War, or in the case of John Negroponte, who was the U.S. ambassador from 1981 to 1985, and who literally, when people would ask him about human rights violations, he'd be like, no, everything's fine. There's nothing happening here. It's perfect. It's a perfect country, right? And then he would then become the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Bush named him U.S. ambassador to the U.N. I think it was just weeks after September 11th, and he was there from 2001 to 2004, and then he became George W. Bush's ambassador to Iraq in 2004. Among so many other things, right? And so there's this really interesting through line between 1980s Honduras to the War on Terror, in which all of these people are involved in, to even Trump and his war kind of on Venezuela and whatnot. And that's in particular for Elliot Abrams, right? Elliot Abrams was Reagan's Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs. He's the U.S. Deputy National Security Advisor in the 2000s. And then he's named by Trump to be Trump's U.S. Special Representative for Venezuela in 2019 through 2021. And that's, of course, when Juan Guaido names himself president and the U.S. recognizes it. And then he's there just constantly backing the, you know, the Guaido government. So that is something that's extremely important to remember, is that oftentimes the United States kind of learns, or different individuals learn, how to do things from certain spots. And this is also, let me just say, none of this is me oh, this is what I found. Like, this is all stuff that other people have dug into and they have learned and I'm trying to synthesize, right? So a lot of this stuff is also talked about in historian Greg Grandin's, you know, amazing book, Empire's Workshop, where it's interesting. In the very first edition, I interviewed him for the first episode of Under the Shadow. And I interviewed him roughly 20 years ago around about Empire's Workshop, just a couple of years after it came out. And recently he was telling me how in that first edition, he was trying to write about how so many people in the 2000s and in the war on terror, Bush's war on terror, got their start in Latin America. And his editors at the time were like, you know what, you're not going to want to include all this stuff because later on, it's not going to be that important. Like, we're not going to be talking about the war on terror, you know, 20 years later. And so there's a new version where he added new stuff and took out new stuff that came out just a couple of years ago, which he's like, I don't need all the rest of this backstory. But it is important to understand how so many people got their start in Honduras at that time that would then become extremely important later for future administrations. About COFADE, throughout my podcast, I speak a lot about kind of historical memory, right? And the importance of remembering the past, honoring the past, and keeping it alive. And we see that in so many different ways. You know, in episode 3, I walked to a memorial for the disappeared in Guatemala. And of course, there's Raya de Venceremos and all these different places. I try and kind of go to these different locations, which are memorials for the past, historical memory to remember the past. And that's something that COFADE continues to do. It's literally in front of Berta Oliva's office is where she has kind of her shrine for the disappeared, which is extremely powerful. And they just last December, they just launched a new museum, the Museum Against Forgetting. And I wanted to visit this. It wasn't open when I was there last year. It's in a town called Amariteca, and it's a former home clandestine torture center, detention center. And they took it and they've opened it up to the public and made it into a museum honoring the victims. And it's extremely, extremely powerful. They released a short little video about it, and I include this in my episode here. And in the video, Berta Oliva is sitting in front of a wall. And it's interesting how they did this to keep like the history alive. Along the wall, you see these kind of marks along the wall. And she says, these are bloodstains from the torture that was happening here at the time. They actually did like DNA tests and tests to discover exactly what it was. And they didn't paint over it. They left it there because that's the idea of like, we need to honor the past, remember the past, honor the victims to ensure that these things never happen again. And she has this really powerful quote, right? Where she just says, they've hidden the past from us. They've denied us the truth. And at this moment that we are narrating this story, it's like we're opening the windows. And that's just so profound because you see in the little documentary, as she's saying this, like the windows of the house are open, right? They're opening those windows for the first time, shine the light in, right? And that's what they continue to do. It's what COFADE continues to do. It's what I'm trying to do with this podcast. And yeah, thank you so much, Oscar.
And this is why we're creating a link to not only this episode, but pretty much all the episodes for Under the Shadow on our Twitter account. We've been speaking with Michael Fox. He's a freelance producer and writer. His most recent project, again, is Under the Shadow, which is a co-production of NACLA and the Real News Network. Michael, as always, it's been fun and insightful. Thank you for being on the show with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
You got it. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We are out of time. You can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
From WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Friday, March 22nd. Here are some headlines. Congress released a $1.2 trillion bill yesterday to ensure the government is funded through the fiscal year. It's not yet clear, however, if Congress will be able to pass the legislation ahead of the midnight deadline today and avert a partial government shutdown over the weekend. Earlier today, the bill passed in the House, which puts it now in the hands of the Senate. A brief weekend shutdown would have limited impact. Essential federal workers still scheduled to work this weekend would have to work without pay. But if it goes longer, thousands of workers would go unpaid and key services would be interrupted. As for what's in the bill, non-defense spending will be relatively flat compared with the prior year, which means many agencies will not see their budgets keep up with inflation. Meanwhile, defense spending would increase more than 3%, which means that more than 70% of the money would go to defense. In related news, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene today introduced a motion to vacate against House Speaker Mike Johnson, threatening a vote to remove him. Greene isn't yet forcing the vote to remove Johnson as Speaker, but the move lays the groundwork for another showdown on the House floor. Johnson's predecessor, Representative Kevin McCarthy, became the first House Speaker to be ousted after hardline Republicans triggered a motion to vacate against him last year. Greene's move came after she voiced extreme opposition to the $1.2 trillion spending bill the House passed today to avert a government shutdown. In other news, Russia and China today vetoed a U.S. draft UN Security Council resolution which called for an immediate and sustained ceasefire in Gaza, along with the release of all remaining hostages held by Hamas. This was the fourth time since the war began in October that the Security Council failed to agree on a resolution calling for a ceasefire. This time, the dispute was over the U.S. insistence on linking the ceasefire call to a hostage deal and condemnation of Hamas, rather than the unconditional ceasefire resolution demanded by Russia and China. The U.S. has vetoed three previous resolutions before the Security Council that called for a ceasefire without any conditions, such as the release of hostages. In related news, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said today that he is determined to send troops into the southern Gaza city of Rafah and would do so without U.S. support. He made the announcement after meeting with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, during which Blinken reiterated that the U.S. does not support a military campaign into Rafah, saying that it would be a humanitarian disaster. An estimated 1.5 million Palestinians, over half of Gaza's population, have taken refuge in the city. The White House has said it will not support a Rafah operation without the Israelis presenting a credible plan to ensure the safety of Palestinian civilians. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned of a gigantic tragedy should the invasion move ahead. And in weather today in Washington, it is 51 degrees under cloudy skies,